Reform Technology and Elections. The agenda for today, I'm looking at who's here, and Representative Gunther looks like he's the only one that's here. So he gets to be first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be first.
Representative Gunther, I believe the first one we have is House File 3224.
That's fine with me.
We don't have a quorum yet, so we can't move the bill, but why don't you go over the bill and what it entails, and once we have a quorum, we'll move it.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and...
Yeah, Representative Gunther, there's a sheet that's prepared by Mr. Shepard. Only those parts of the bill are in the purview of this committee, and that'll save you some time. And
very well, Mr. Chairman.
And you're testifying, so if you want to take a minute and look at it, that's fine.
Be great, thank you.
I do really appreciate that. Thank you.
I think I'm ready to comply with your wishes.
All right.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
House File 3224 came to us basically out of necessity by the Workforce Center in Mankato. They pointed out very clearly there was not enough chief boiler inspectors to take care and open the plants like the ethanol plants, food processing plants, and so forth. And because of the shortage, the chief boiler inspector, Mr. Amato, came up with a solution that is in this bill. It allows first classes to fill a billet as long as they're under training with the company and fulfilling, working towards the requirement of the chief. And with that, I would certainly allow Mr. Amato to go through it. You go for it.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Joel Amato, and I'm Chief Boiler Inspector with the Department of Labor and Industry. We are asking for the rulemaking authority for continuing education for licensed boiler operators. We have formed a committee that has 18 members, and the consensus of the Boiler Advisory Committee is to create continuing education requirements for the 10 classes of boiler operator licenses. Because the committee was formed only 6 months ago, and they did not have time to address this issue, the department and the committee are requesting rulemaking authority to have the time to work with businesses and licensed engineers to develop a continuing education program that will address the concerns of industry and provide the education requirements needed by the licensed engineers of Minnesota. And this is for the Continuing Education Rulemaking Authority.
All right. Any questions to the bill? No questions? Any other testifiers?
Yeah.
No. Okay. We have a quorum?
Mr. Chairman and members,
wait 1 second. Representative Gunther, this bill has been in finance already, is that correct?
No. Not yet.
No.
This bill doesn't have any money to it.
We're discussing whether or not there's a negligible fiscal note to this, but apparently we can't find one. So I would move that House File 3224 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. And is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. First time comes, you have another bill, House File 3913.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
And that does go to the Finance Committee?
That's correct.
So I will move that House File 3913 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 3913 is establishing a new commission, the Combative Sports Commission. It's the old boxing board, and it includes six other fighting venues in it. And the state has an obligation, or at least a moral obligation, to make sure that fights are safe throughout the state. Everyone that is fair and the people combatants are healthy. And I think basically that's what we're trying to establish, the rules.
Again, let's come down to the salient parts of the bill are on the memo from Mr. Shepard. Those sections of the bill, I don't know if you need to address any of those or your testifier needs to address any of those. Are they dramatically different than the old boxing commission other than by name or?
Other than the things I laid out, we have the same board that has oversight over the actions of the Combative Sports Commission. And
so that's kind of extensive. When you use the word combative or combatants, you're not referring to the legislature in any way?
Well, we could, but I'm not.
You're not. That's unfortunate, considering what's happened, you know, recently on the floor and in some committees.
Mr. Chairman, I would really encourage the members of the committee to actually look at the language in this bill. It's very interesting. It defines individuals as living human beings. and I'm not sure if that definition is consistent throughout statute. It also defines an amateur tough person, which I find interesting. And I'm wondering, just my question to Representative Gunther is, why are they discriminating against Ultimate Fighting?
Because the majority of people that we've been before think Ultimate Fighting is a brutal sport, and they would just as well not have it in Minnesota. However, if they can fulfill all the requirements in this bill, they can have a fighting venue, but it's a common belief that that's impossible.
All right. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gunther, amateur tough person. Person. Why isn't that individual? How is that person, the word person, different from individual in your bill?
Representative Gunther, would you like your testifier? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Give another lawyer.
Thank you very much. My name is Pat Munkel Olson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Labor and Industry, and here to speak to you on behalf of this bill. The definition of, there is a distinction between an individual, and then the definition of person also includes other legally recognized entities and the individual. And so for the word person does encompass both the individual and other corporations. And we could certainly amend that to say tough individual, but it's not the vernacular of the industry.
Representative Emmer, they may have opened up a whole new legal area for you.
Mr. Chairman, actually they may have opened it up for you.
Oh, even better. Representative Gunther, do you wish to testify any further to the bill? Go over anything?
I'm happy to answer whatever questions that I'm able to.
Seeing no other questions, Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, I don't think it's clear to me why we need this.
Representative Gunther. Ms. Hilty.
If I may, thank you. The purpose of the bill is to change the name of it to properly encompass the jurisdiction of the Boxing Commission, which was created in 2006 and amended last session in 2007. The jurisdiction of the Boxing Commission is currently professional boxing, amateur and professional tough person contests, and amateur and professional mixed martial arts. The change in the name really more appropriately encompasses the jurisdiction, and that was the reason for that change. There were also some terms of art related to some of the definitions that we felt the regulated population would just more readily understand how these statutes are interpreted by giving some additional definitions. The changes to combatants rather than talking about officers or these other athletes was, was really intended to encompass all of the active participants in the sense of the people who are in the ring and actually engaging in the combative components of the sport. So the rulemaking provisions reflect that change, and I could go through that. A lot of them are just for consistencies. In Section 3, for example, the 3 to 4 members that must have knowledge of the boxing industry, that wasn't just my understanding that that was the intention from the very beginning. This just clarifies that. We are engaged in rulemaking, the commission is right now, and so the language about the rulemaking does talk about publishing a notice of intent before September 1st, 2008. And also, the subsequent contests are regulated by the Association of Boxing Commission rule. Boxers, by definition, in 2006, could be regulated by that or something else. And this section on line 5.10 talks about amending that so that those rules, so that we can actually make them consistent with the statute where necessary.
Ms. Olson,
yes?
You said the Boxing Commission went into existence in 2006,
is that correct?
And before that, was it the Boxing Board?
I believe that under the, I don't remember what year, but under the Ventura administration, the Boxing Board was dismantled. And so that was resurrected then again in 2006, as the Boxing
Board. The Boxing Board, and because Representative Kahn has come in, wasn't that under Representative Rice's committee for a long time? Representative Kahn, you claim to be the historian.
Yes, it was actually under my committee for a long time until we abolished it, we combined it with wrestling, we made it self-funding, and we did all kinds of things. And then it was decided that Salmon Rice would be a more sympathetic place for it to go. So it went there.
I think
maybe after I introduced the bill to abolish boxing in the state.
I believe to Representative Hilton's point, though, and this could help Representative Gunther, the reason why it's here, as Representative Rice used to say, that once we pass this bill, you will never darken our doorstep again. So this is it.
It's my intention that will be the case.
Well, that answers Representative Hilty's question. Any further questions?
Jim.
Representative Kahn.
My only question about it is, how is the funding of this done?
Representative Gunther, you want to answer that? Or Ms. Olson? Ms. Olson?
Well, there is a $50,000 budget appropriations that occurred in 2006 and 2007, and there is a an item in there that gives an additional $80,000 on top of that.
Thank you.
Chairman, I will point out that of all the boards and commissions we have, this is about the only one that's supported by state general funds to support an activity of whom the primary goal of this activity is to injure the brain of another person.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, primary function of the Boxing Board and of the Combative Sports Commission is to protect David from Goliath. It is to make sure that the fights are well matched and fair and the combatants are healthy. And where Representative Kahn and I probably share the same thought about one person beating another person's head or whatever, it is something that the state has had an obligation to do for years. It was discontinued, sent down, our obligation was sent down to Iowa for a while. They quit theirs. The majority of states do have a commission, and this one is going to be partially or completely, they hope, self-funded in the future.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, you deny that the principal aim
of a boxing match is to injure the brain of the opponent?
Representative Gunther.
I don't know if that's the principle, but often it is an effect from a causal effect of boxing.
Well,
Representative
Mr. Chairman, isn't that what a knockout is?
Representative, I don't know if you need to answer all of these, but these are not really in the purview of this. It's for Health and Human Services, I think.
Mr. Chairman, the language for the ultimate fighting thing was brought forth by a recommendation by Representative Kahn already, and it is virtually impossible, like I said, to have an ultimate fighting contest in Minnesota.
Why are we lowering the fees when this is not a self-supporting commission?
Representative Gunther, again, the fees are not the purview of the committee.
Is it still going
to finance? It's going to finance.
Oh, okay.
It's going to finance.
Which division?
Well, we're going to send it to finance because in that marvelous system that we have, they will divine which committee it goes to from finance.
Maybe they'll send it to me.
So. We can only. Representative Gunther is hoping that himself. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 3913 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee, and from there, wherever it's going to go. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Gunther. Sailor. Where's Sailor? Oh, all right. Representative Sailor, House File 3665. All right. Representative Sailor, I will move that House File 3665 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a technical bill for the Auditor's Office. It is a good government bill, and the State Auditor is here to address this bill if there are any questions, but it's primarily technical. Thank you.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rebecca Otto, State Auditor. This is a quick bill. It's not controversial. It's brought to you because our office had a working group with the Volunteer Fire Relief Association folks, and the recommendation was obtained by consensus by the working group, which consisted of myself, the Pension Commission staff, volunteer firefighters, fire service organization representatives, and municipal representatives. And what this does is there's already a provision in law that requires public officials of local political subdivisions, local governments, already are required to report under this provision if they become aware of theft or misuse of public funds. So that would be of pension funds or other funds within local government. Or, excuse me, for the current law, it's any misuse of government funds. A report must be made to local law enforcement, and a written report must be submitted to our office. All this bill does is expand it to local public pension plans. And when we're talking to the group, because we have seen some theft in public pension plans, and so we want to make sure that they are aware that we want to have a provision in law that they have to report, and then we want to make sure that we can do education with them to say to make sure they do, so if there is theft, that we can stop, that we can get in and make sure there's proper internal controls.
Any questions? Seeing no questions, I'll renew my motion that House File 3665 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Loffler, I thought I saw her. There she is. Fine.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members.
Good morning. Representative Loffler, I'll move that House File 3891 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. So, to your bill.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. House File 3891 is reinvigorating the Minnesota Milestones process. It was much more a visible and active process in the past to reestablish as the basis for goal setting within our budget process and accountability to our state agencies and community in terms of whether we're directing our activities, our investments towards the vision and the future that the citizens of Minnesota have identified and shared. Minnesota Milestones began under Governor Carlson's administration back in 1991, inspired by the belief that, you know, a clear vision, clear measurable goals, and accountability for results would actually focus everyone towards actual achievement. And at the time, it was considered sort of a groundbreaking effort, but I think since then, many states have moved far beyond us in terms of performance measurement in state services and into relating that to its budget. And this bill before us proposes that we reexamine the Minnesota Milestone goals and measures to make sure that they're current and that there's broad and wide ownership of them, and then directly relate them to our budget process, so that instead of in our budget divisions looking at just an odd hodgepodge collection of pilot projects and small initiatives here and there, every change item would be related to what is it contributing towards this vision of the future. And a legislative subcommittee of the Commission on Government Accountability would be established to look at this and to work with the administration on a process of reforming our budget to better fit with that. Just to give you an example of the sort of things that I'm talking about and that have been used in the past, the original Milestones had a set of 19 general purpose sort of big visions and then very specific indicators under it. For example, a goal would be our children will not live in poverty. That's fairly easy to measure through child poverty and low-income children. But in terms of families will provide a stable, supportive environment for their children with satisfaction with child care, the amount of school transfers, child abuse and neglect, teen pregnancy, runaway. We had very specific measures that were consistent across time. There has been a community initiative evolving at the same time along a similar line through the Twin Cities Compass, the University of Minnesota Wilder Research Center, working in partnership with the State Demographer's Office, Senator Tara Clark in the Senate, to really look at how to move this forward in a way that will actually assist our partners in the community, both private and nonprofit, in working towards those goals as well. And the Twin Cities Compass is actually gathering that data right now on a metropolitan basis. So this is not envisioning that we would once again reestablish the State Planning Agency with a lot of staff people working in it. It would instead be done in partnership with the university, the State Demographer's Office, and community partners who are actually out there in the field right now keeping track of these measures. It, for us, it's really about our budget process really being tied to those visions and having our agencies report back on performance. I have with me our State Demographer, Tom Gillespie, who's been involved in this project from its beginning as well as its sort of reemergence, and he can give the committee a little bit more background.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Members of the committee. My name is Tom Gillespie, and I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Department of Administration, and I'm available to answer or attempt to answer any questions that you might have this morning. I was involved in the initial efforts with Minnesota Milestones, with the public meetings that we gathered, as well as the pulling together that information and development of the indicator series. I have also worked with a team of advisors, which also included other people such as the state economist and other people in state, working with the Citizens League and Wilder Foundation in their attempt at pulling together the Twin City Compass, which is now in operation. So I have been involved in many aspects of this effort.
Any discussion? Representative Khan.
I'm interested in the last Section 5, where we have, when does the commissioner submit recommendations required? When
under 16A.10 subdivision 1C.
Representative
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, if you'll see the unit under the previous page, section 3 under 2.22, it's by July 15th. It's every even numbered year, and June 15th of every even numbered year, they report to the Subcommittee of Governmental Accountability, which is part of our Legislative Commission on Fiscal Accountability, on how to design the budget documents to accommodate this and the performance measures. And then, as you know, in our Section 5, the working group includes legislative staff, agency staff, others to make sure that the budget format is going to work for everyone.
At some time.
What's the purpose for the expiring 30 days after the recommendations have been submitted?
Representative Lawson.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahn, my sense is that it could be continuing. I think the thought was that they really would have at that point have done their major work, and it wasn't supposed to be, you know, sort of a monthly meeting forever and ever, but that they focus their work on those even-numbered years and then come back when we're once again at a point where we need to rethink about the next budget design.
Representative Kahn?
Kevin, the reason I raise that question is that we've often extended, and maybe this one is different, we've extended groups because if you want to question the group, you know, after it's been submitted, which is in the summer, as I gather, so there aren't a lot of people around, there isn't anyone around to call to account if there's something that you don't like in what they've done. So I just...
All right. That's an issue we can definitely pursue further in terms of whether this should be some ongoing thing. It was just to make sure this didn't become sort of a burdensome obligation with a lot of meetings that didn't have purpose. But in terms of being able to be available, I would think that would be, and we could refine that in the committee.
I mean,
I
don't know that it needs to continue, but I also don't need that it needs know that it needs to expire by law. You know, why can't we just delete that last sentence?
Is that a motion, Representative Kahn?
No.
Just a suggestion. What? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Loeffler, can you just help me understand better why it is designated in the language that the committee shall consider testimony from the following groups, and you have 1.18 to 1.21. The reason I'm asking is that it seems like there's many more stakeholders than are listed here, and I'm wondering why they're listed and why others are not. I mean, I have in mind taxpayers obviously have a stake in how the budgets are designed and implemented in the state. For-profit companies have all sorts of other things that they use in their businesses, and why wouldn't they be at the table in helping provide further government accountability? And those two come to mind. I'm just wondering why these are designated.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bodd, if you look on page 3, on line 3.13, we actually have the Minnesota Fiscal Centennial Commission designated to this year solicit that type of broad-based community input and feed it into that process. Now, that's to tee up this process. In the future, we may need, you know, another group of people, but this is a statewide effort that's engaged in all 87 counties, and so the thought was that you would actually have that public process complementing the sort of more insider and more measurement-focused input from the specific entities that are named at the beginning of the bill.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Loeffler, I would love to work with you in trying to figure out how you add to that, because I don't think that just insiders should be making those decisions. I appreciate that you're going out and having the sesquicentennial, bringing people into the process on the outside, but I certainly think that this should be expanded on the upfront if you're going to be going this direction.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rose, I think, you know, that's part of why we have the subcommittee involved, is to design the process in a way that's going to work. Many of the partners that are listed here are actually expected to be the people who are gathering the measurements, and that will inform our progress towards achieving those, which I think is you know, a valuable contribution and has been, it's been exciting to see the Twin Cities Compass actually moving in that direction, where I think our business community and the public is interested in seeing, are we making progress, where are we going, how can we hold all stakeholders to that vision and dream of a better future for all.
Representative Olschweiger.
Chair members, actually, Mr. Gillespie, do you have a suggestion for us as to, you know, you're the demographer of the state. I mean, how would we, is there a way to go about cross-sectioning Minnesota and trying to get at, you know, a good cross-section of Minnesota?
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walsh, my understanding of Section 1 is that that is a fairly narrow view of how to improve and update the current Minnesota milestones, which is now 8 years out of date. The indicators are 8 years out of date and haven't been updated since then. And the internet platform on which that is built is fairly dated and needs to be brought up to date. And so my understanding is that this first section would refer to that fairly narrow concept of how to improve the current use of Minnesota milestones. When Governor Carlson first conceived of the idea of Minnesota milestones, the concept was to interview people throughout the state and to develop a unified vision of where the people of Minnesota would like to see the state going. We held facilitated group interviews in all corners of the state, representing, as to the best of my knowledge, virtually every interest group and every group of concern in the state. Literally thousands of people were interviewed and looking towards the general question we ask is what would you like Minnesota to look like for your children in 2020? So it wasn't, you know, what would you like to see? It was, what do you want to, what would you like Minnesota to look like in the future? And the idea was to develop a vision of where we would like to be, and then to develop indicators that would indicate our progress towards that vision. And so it is a sort of a dual effort of both vision and some indication of progress. My understanding is that Section 4 would attempt to update some of that vision and to double check it to make sure that is still relevant. But Section 1 and Section 5 would deal very specifically with the very narrow issue of how do we update the current indicators and update the platform on which that is available.
Representative Olschweiger, does that answer your question?
Yes, no.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 3891 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for squeezing it in on a busy day.
Well, we'll see how he's going to do it. Rotem Hoshert, there he is. Come on down. Rotem, is this bill, before we amend it, would it go to the general register?
Mr. Chair, yes, it would.
All right. I'll move that House File 3435 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. And then I believe you have an amendment for us?
Yep, Mr. Chair. I would like to amend by deleting Article 1, lines 1.11 through lines 12.1.
All right, let's take this a little slowly. Mr. Shepherd is here. Can you repeat that so Mr. Shepherd has it?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I would like to have deleted in House File 3435 lines 1.11 through 12.16, and this would include the deletion of the entire Article 1.
Mr. Shepherd, if I move that amendment, what else would have to be done in the amendment to make the bill work?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe it would work as stated. I will write it up from Ms. Anderson with a title amendment, and but otherwise it works. I believe it works just the way you stated it.
All right. Then I'll move that amendment. All those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right. Rick Hodge, your bill is now amended to the form I believe you wish it to be. So to the bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3435 is the Department of Human Services technical bill. The items of interest to this committee include the extension of three committees or advisory councils, which include the Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Committee, the American Indian Advisory Council, and the Citizens Advisory Council. And we simply extend their expiration dates to 2012.
All right.
And I have staff here for questions.
Representative Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoster actually made this here testify. I'm just curious where the first article is going, because there's actually some good provisions in there. Is it being attached somewhere else, or is it just, I'm just wondering what's happening to that part with the children's mental health?
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, I'm Carrie Erber, Mr. Chair and members.
Just 1 second. Could you repeat your name, please?
Sure. Carrie Erber from the Department of Human Services.
Okay. Thank you.
And I may have to call somebody else up if I don't answer all your questions because they're from the mental health division. Basically, it was a technical bill that had some complications that providers, or they didn't think it was a technical, so we just removed it. It was removed from the Senate side, too, and it's moving. The Senate bill is moving on. It's on the floor.
Representative Broad.
That's fine. There was some good language in there related to the rehabilitative progress for children and things like that. And so I was just curious what was happening to it. But thank you, Representative Hosh.
All right. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cott.
We're trying to find out what the repealer is. Sorry. He's fussing.
Let's just see what. I guess the Shepherd. Unless, would you know what the repealer is?
I've got it.
All right, Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, the repealer at the end of the bill of 256B.039 is a requirement that beginning March 1st, 2002, the commissioner reports to the legislature annually on the use of supplemental nursing services.
Any questions on the repealer? No. Any further discussion? Then I'll renew my motion that House File 3435, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hart. Representative Severson, I think there he is. Representative Severson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Representative Severson, Senate File 3443, I'll move be recommended to pass to be placed under General Register.
Yes.
All right. And to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is yesterday, 2 days ago, I believe it was on the House floor, we heard the Memorial Day for Vietnam veterans. And as I sat on the Veterans Committee, and that bill went through the Veterans Committee, one of the members from one of the organizations came up to me and said, no, this is great, but what about the Korean War? And really, the Korean War got labeled the Forgotten War. And so this is kind of the follow-on on that particular issue. The difference, and Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move an oral amendment And the oral amendment is that on line 1.2...
Representative Stevenson, I'm not terribly fond of oral amendments, but if Mr. Shepard has the amendment, what he'll do is repeat it so that we're all clear on what it is, and then it will be inserted in written form. So if we could have Mr. Shepard explain what the amendment is. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, and I do have this written down. This puts the Senate file, which is in front of the committee, back in the form that the House committee acted on the bill, and it just substitutes the word armistice for veterans in three places, and that's in the title, on page 1, line 2, delete veterans and insert armistice. Then on page 1, line 5, in the head note, delete veterans and insert armistice. And then on page 1, line 22, delete veterans and insert armistice. I believe those are the
yes,
authors.
That's right. Representative Stevenson, that's the amendment?
Yes.
Any discussion to the amendment? I will then move the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, thank that. The reason for that is that we have currently have a Veterans Memorial Day, and one of the issues is that a little of what we experienced on the House floor yesterday is there tends to be a partisan or a dividing up of individual veterans and the place that they served or the individuals who they served for. For the Memorial Day, it's a day to honor all veterans. This particular day in July 27, 1953 was the Armistice Day. That was the cessation of hostilities in Korea. And the federal government had this day recognized on their books until 2003, and then it dropped off the books. That's the reason we're putting it in the Minnesota statute. We prefer to do that is to continue to recognize the sacrifice that those warriors who gave their lives and those who came home to remember their service in defending our country. And I would stand for questions.
Mr. Chairman, before I move an amendment to delete a line, I guess I'd like to ask Representative Severson to defend it, and that's on page 1.18, line 118 and 119, saying today South Korea stands as a shining example of the economic and social benefits of democracy. Can you give us one example of why that's true?
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahn. I spent 2.5 years in Japan and did several short tours in Korea during that time frame, and it was a thriving and is a thriving democracy. It's one of those that has really grabbed onto the issue of freedom and in terms of their communities, in terms of their economies. They have, I think, done a fairly culturally good job of allowing their citizens to run a free market system. So I would have to say, in terms of the verbiage in this particular take, and I'd have to see if this, I don't know that this was part of a federal write-in. It might have been. But that would be my defense, Representative Kahn.
Representative Kahn.
You know, I guess it's in passing. I'm not sure it's very informative. So there is a federal statement. There is a, we have, well, this is modeled over some federal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, that's correct.
I mean, my tendency would be to take that line out unless you have a little bit more documentation. In fact, I think I'll move that.
Okay, Representative Kahn.
Why not?
Go ahead, move it.
Oh, well, whatever.
Go ahead, move it. I want Mr. Shepard to make sure it's written out before we proceed.
I want to move to delete on 1.18 after the period after the last sentence on 1.18 and 1.19.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, I do have that written out on page 1, line 18, delete today, comma, south, and then delete page 1, line 19.
And Mr. Chair.
And Severson, you want to speak to that amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I think I give a little bit of an explanation, but I think there also needs to be a contrast drawn between North and South Korea. and the results of what would have happened had we not intervened in that particular process, looking at what has taken place in North Korea and then contrasting that with South Korea. It's easy to take a look when you look at some of the satellite imagery of the Asian Peninsula there, and you take a look at the lights, the lack of lights in North Korea, and the huge bustling industry that's taken place in South Korea. And I don't think it stretches the imagination much to say that there is a shining contrast that is literally an example to the world at this point.
First time, Brad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I would hope that we would go with Representative Severson on this against the Khan Amendment. He made a very good case, and I request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Is there any further discussion?
Well, Chair members, I'm going to support Representative Khan on this simply because I don't think that sentence is worth arguing about. In terms of a Korean War Armistice Day, you know, you're trying to remember our vets, I believe, right? And we're not trying to make a statement about South Korea. So, I mean, I wouldn't have brought up this amendment on my own, but now that Representative Khan has brought it to my attention, this isn't really about South Korea. It's about the U.S. veterans. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if Representative Severson prefers a conference committee of 3 members or 5 members.
Representative Severson, why don't you wait till after the roll call? And any further discussion? Then the clerk will take the roll on the amendment.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Broad?
No.
Representative Emmer?
No.
Representative Tokay?
Aye.
Representative Hollis? Representative Khan?
Yes.
Representative Chairman?
No.
Representative Morgan?
No.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Olson? Representative Posse?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Winter?
Yes.
Chair votes no. There being 9 nays and 3 ayes, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is just a short bill. I'm hoping that we can pass it out of here and get on the House floor and recognize the service of those. And again, this is about the Armistice Day. And my desire is not to parcel out any more special recognition for veterans. We have that currently, but a recognition. We have Victory Over Europe Day. We have Victory Over Japan Day. We have Armistice Day for World War One, and this just kind of goes down in our records as being a day of memory for that battle that took place and the members who were there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Olson. Chair members, Representative Severson, does this cover it now? I mean...
No.
Representative Severson, you want to answer that question? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, and Representative Wolfschlager, when you're talking about, are you talking about the Korean War conflict?
No, I'm talking about Armistice.
Representative Wolfschlager. Representative Severson, I don't know if that's applicable to this bill or not. But.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wolfschlager, again, the reason that I brought this forward was because there was people in the service organizations that had felt like, and if you take a look at what transpired with the veterans who came back from Korea, a lot of them came home and people looked at them and said, where were you? And so this was labeled the Forgotten War. So this is the reason that this has come forward, is that they served their country and they were forgotten. So does this meet all the expectations? I would expect that in the future sometime we would probably have, you know, the War on Terror, hopefully. And this is part of something that I think we left out of our past, and this is an effort to plug that gap.
President Cox.
Mr. Chairman and members, I know everyone is waiting for my bill commemorating the service of those who fought in the Lincoln Brigade in the war in Spain, the first war against fascism.
Representative Conn, we were hoping for the 1812 Drummer Boy commemorative. It's not coming?
No, not today.
That was a pension issue.
Yeah.
Sorry. That was Any further discussion? I'll renew my motion that Senate File 3443 be recommended to, is amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Hortman, is she here?
Yes.
Oh, there she is. Representative Hortman, House File 3807. I'll move that it be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, to you, Bill.
Mr. Chair, this bill expands the Whistleblower Protection Act and Minnesota statutes to extend to employees in the executive branch who communicate in good faith with the members of the legislature or their staff, or to elected officials in the executive branch about measures that they believe would improve the efficiency of the agency. Over the fall, Representative Simon and Senator Resch convened a group of DFL legislators to look at government reform and accountability measures because there's a frustration among sophomore level legislators and freshmen that there's things that we should be looking at that make government run more smoothly and make it more accountable. And one of our frustrations was that we couldn't directly speak with employees of executive branch agencies without going through the commissioner's office and having a political staff person in on the meeting. And it did seem to inhibit the free flow of information. And we've had situations with the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health where we haven't been able to get information that would have helped us to react sooner as a legislature to problems. And that's all I have to say about the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hortman, can you tell me how this bill differs from House File 3933?
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, no, I cannot. I have not seen that House file.
Well, this
Representative Emmer.
That's interesting, Mr. Chair, because this is a House file that you are a co-author on with Representative Loeffler. And it's titled, I believe it was heard in this committee about a week ago, and it looks to be almost the same bill, and if you like, I'd be happy to give you this copy so you can tell me how your bill is different from the one that we've already heard.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, I'd love to see the bill. Mr. Chair, if I recall correctly, when Representative Loeffler showed me her bill, I thought mine was simpler, but I see at, I don't know if the line and page numbers that you have are similar to the line and page numbers here, but it looks to be that paragraph F is exactly the same. So there's other provisions of the Loeffler amendment. I don't have section one, for example, of her amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you. Representative Hortman, and why is this necessary? Because is there some instance that you're trying to address specific?
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, there's three situations that come to mind so far, but in the group discussions this fall and this winter, I can't remember the specifics of the other ones. I do recall Representative Sumper had considerable difficulty getting testimony from somebody from the Department of Agriculture. I believe that person encountered quite a degree of objection to communicating with the legislature on an issue, I believe, related to atrazine. And then with regard to the Minnesota Department of Health, over this summer, Representative Rukavina had a hearing up in Mountain Iron with former Commissioner Diane Mondernach to talk about the lack of the release of information on the study concerning mesothelioma. And during the course of that hearing, we reviewed several documents and emails from employees in the Department of Health talking about what they should do about the study information and whether further study was required and how they should release it and when they should release it and what they should say politically about it. But talking to the legislature about getting more funding to address the serious issues raised was not one of the options that they considered. And I'm blanking on a third.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer. Thank you. Representative Hortman, I'm not sure how discussions about funding at the Department of Health would involve whistleblower stuff. I guess I would ask, I would like the specific instances that you're trying to address here that you believe have been, that this would address, not that I think it's a bad idea, but the whistleblower law and certain immunities, I think, already apply. So I'm concerned that you're creating language that is not only, is it not perhaps necessary, but it might create confusion with different areas of law. And that's why I was asking how yours was different from the other one that you've authored. Is there a reason why your bill doesn't include Section 1 of your other bill with Representative Loeffler?
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, to your first question, to identify particular employees and particular executive agencies, that would defeat the point of the whole bill, which is that the members of the executive branch staff level have communicated with legislators outside of the permitted protocol within the agencies on occasion, and other members of the staff of the executive agency have attempted to go through the correct protocol and have been prevented from testifying. So the whole purpose of putting this protection into place is to make executive branch agencies, which I believe are the real experts on these issues, to make them aware that they're not part of the political games that go on, they're not part of the political disputes, but they can just provide information and facts and recommendations based on their expertise. And your second question about Representative Loeffler's bill, I suppose we could talk about a different time. We're really here to talk about my bill and what it does. I'm not sure Representative Loeffler's bill is going forward or what her exact point is in offering the parts that I'm not offering.
All right. Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Emmer,
I would just conclude then that's frankly, if you don't want to answer the second question, that's fine. But the answer to the first question is, frankly, it's outrageous because on the one hand, you say that there's a problem that you're trying to address and you cite the Representative Chumper and some vague reference to the Department of Agriculture, and then you cite to Representative Rukavina and some funding issue with the Department of Health and the unfortunate realities of northern Minnesota, the miners in northern Minnesota. And then when I ask you for specifics, what are you trying to solve, and aren't you going to create more confusion, your response is, well, that would totally defeat what I'm trying to do here. I can't tell you the answer to that, because then that's why we need the law, the whistleblower law. I think if this, and I have a feeling, Representative Hortman, that I may not be on the majority side of this vote, just have a sneaking suspicion that this might get out of this committee today, and I'm sure we'll have an interesting discussion about it on the floor. But thank
members,
you
we do have
trying.
one person who wishes to testify if they want to come down. I realize that. Well, before we go to more questions, members, I want to have welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Employee Relations. I'm also the State Labor Negotiator. I'm here to testify about some concerns about the bill. I think in principle that I'm here also to say that I don't think any state employee who wants to meet with a legislator or their legislator should have any fear of retribution, but I think that there are some certain points that I think that need to be clarified. And first of all, I've been a state employee for over 35 years. I've worked in several administrations and I've worked under several commissioners. And I don't think there's anything wrong for an administration to have a policy if you're contacted by a legislator to have a system of how this information is communicated and transmitted. Otherwise, we'll have chaos in our workplace. So I don't think that sends a chilling effect to our employees in the workplace, but nevertheless, I believe that under any administration that certain protocols about the work that we provide have to have some element of communications. Otherwise, we're caught off guard in a lot of instances, and we want to make sure that people are given all of the information instead of certain portions. I administer the discipline for state employees in the executive branch. I do not administer the discipline for the Minsky faculty. So when I say executive branch, I want to make sure I exclude that part, because sometimes I've been asked that. I know of no instance in my career where a state employee has been disciplined for contacting their legislator and talking to the legislator. I know of no circumstance. Now, if there is an image of that out there, I'm certainly anxious to work with whomever to make sure that that doesn't happen. What you're creating here is the whistleblower statute, I think, is well defined. It's been in place for several years, and it provides protection to government employees in general, and that's not just state employees, all government employees, for reporting violations of law. But there's also another component that's outside of the whistleblower protection law, and that's our First Amendment rights as government. Public employees are protected for reporting matters which are considered to be of public concern. That's already case law in several courts throughout the United States as well as in the state of Minnesota. And so I believe that there are protections there as well. What you're basically doing is you're saying that any state employee who communicates information that they believe in good faith to be truthful and accurate that will improve services. And the concern that I have from an employer point of view, and one of the unfortunate phenomenons in this business is we do discipline employees, is that in some instances we're going to be discussing what was this, was it accurate, was it truthful. We're going to be in district court. It's going to be litigated. Most of our employees are represented by labor unions, and they have a just cause component in their disciplinary action and their labor agreement. And what you're creating here is, in my opinion, another component where employees will then say, I'm not going to choose the collective bargaining agreement. I'm going to take this issue to district court. And then we're going to be stuck with the grievance here and the discipline, and we're going to wait for years for this matter to be litigated. A couple of other points that I want to share with you through. The other would be, and that is the election of remedies. I think that if this bill proceeds, I think if an employee wants to proceed with this, then they should say that they're no longer going to use the grievance procedure. Because we could be sitting on a grievance for 3 or 4 years while this is litigated in court. The other is the data. I've met with legislators for many years in my position. I have access to medical data on people. I have access to a variety of information. And if this employee meets with you and provides you with serious confidential data about individuals, are they going to be protected, or should they be protected from that? And I'm not sure, but I think that those are some of the issues that you need to be aware of. I also believe that as I said earlier, that if someone believes that they've been disciplined solely for that, I've just never heard of that. But what are we going to do if you have a probationary employee that doesn't have this right? What are we going to do if we have an unclassified employee? And it just poses a whole host of employment-related problems for us. Again, I want to emphasize, I know of no circumstances where an employee has been disciplined for merely speaking out and talking to their legislator or a legislator. Thank you.
Right, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to give Representative Winkler his due, too, because he was integrally involved in this effort, too, and he and I sort of co-chaired the House component. But I want to get to the bill. You know, I have a specific example as well in dealing with MnDOT and talking with employees who were authorized to talk to me. So they had authorization to talk to me, but felt that they couldn't tell me certain objective information when I asked about, say, a software capability or about how things are prioritized in terms of, is it done by software, is there a meeting, or what have you. People felt they couldn't talk to me. So that's just another example. But I think, Mr. Larson, I think I understand your general concern, which is you don't want a chaotic workplace and there ought to be standards, and I agree with that. I think the chief executive or through the commissioner ought to have some standards about who can and who can't talk, for example, to the media, or who can or can't talk to the Speaker of the House or legislative leaders. I understand that and I agree with that. But this bill is in addition to an existing statute, and the kind of language that you seem to be calling into question already exists in other portions. And I'm looking here at the bill, for example, on line 2.2. There, too, there's a standard of what the employee believes to be truthful and accurate. So, theoretically, he'd also be in court today under this very same statute. This very same section of law has these same standards. So I don't think it's quite the danger that you're pointing out, unless you're here to tell us that under the existing law, you've had endless court battles and endless testimony about what an employee does or does not believe to be truthful and accurate and so forth. So I see this as just adding to existing law that already uses this same language. And as I see it, I know that the term whistleblower is a loaded term, and it sort of brings to mind, you know, an employee that discovers some sort of corruption or wrongdoing and wants to report it but can't. I don't see this as that at all, really. I think whistleblower maybe is not the right term for what this bill does. To me, what this bill does is says that if someone is already authorized to talk to a legislator, and maybe they're not, and maybe there's a policy that, you know, all legislative requests go through this person or that person, but if the person is authorized, then the content of what they can talk about is protected here. That if Joe Blow or Jane Doe may talk to a legislator, that person can convey what they know, if it isn't already otherwise covered by some other section of statute. And you bring up data, sensitive data. Under the Data Practices Act, that would already be shielded. So we're not saying there may be objective data that you or some other state employee knows about but can't communicate because it's otherwise prohibited to be disclosed by law. I guess what I'm saying is I don't see this as quite the radical leap that maybe you're conveying here today, because there's other similar language in the statute. And this is just saying, from my standpoint anyway, that employees who are already authorized to talk to legislators can convey objective information without fear of punishment. I've encountered employees who are fearful of being punished, so it never gets to the disciplinary stage because they're fearful of speaking out about objective information, not opinions about whether this commissioner is good or bad or the politics, but do you or don't you use a computer program? Someone shouldn't be afraid of being fired for telling you that.
Mr. Larson, you want to respond?
Well, I can, and I definitely, in response, I agree with the comments from the representative. I know that in my 35 years in my career, I've had situations where I've had legislators call me with very much disdain and anger about state employees calling them, threatening them, and venting with them about certain decisions that are made in the legislative process, and they want them fired. And I tell them they can't do that. And so, I mean, there is a component of this that brings me into all facets. I know of no circumstances where, you know, I think that where an employee has information that a legislator wants, and I, with the data issues, obviously medical data, confidential data, investigative data, I've met with legislators about constituents in their districts that are under investigation, and one of the first things they tell me is they don't want any special privileges, which is a component of this. And so the concern that we have from an employer point of view are just all of the potential obstacles that can be in the way with response to this. Generally speaking, I understand where the representative is going with this. If someone wants to call their legislator and bring forward this information, they should be able to do it without any fear or retribution. I agree with that. We're not here to say that. All I'm here is to say that it creates a whole host of issues for us. And you need to be aware about that when you're voting on it. That's all.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, and I too have been frustrated by trying to get information in the past. A year and a half ago, when I was trying to craft some legislation, and I was at a seminar that was being put on by a couple of employees from the Department of Revenue, and after the seminar was over, I went and talked to them and asked them some questions, and in full disclosure, I told them that I was a state representative, And the discussion went on, well, a couple of days later when I called them and asked them to try to get some more information to try and help craft this legislation to try and close loopholes and try and bring in revenue without raising taxes, I was told that they could no longer talk to me unless their supervisor was present, and to not call them back. And so this does have... What you're saying here is that even though they may not have been disciplined because they no longer would talk to me, it has a chilling effect on the information, and it was not private information. It was just ways that we, I was trying to find ways that we could do to maybe coax legislation to try and get better compliance with our laws that we currently have on the books. And they would no longer talk to me because unless their supervisor was present and they were afraid of what they would say, that they, the fear of getting disciplined was there. So I support this legislation. I think it's a good step. I don't think it's going to chill any employee relationship, and I think it's a good piece of legislation.
Representative Hartman, or Mr. Larkin,
Mr. Chairman, in response to that, I know I've been involved in several discussions throughout my career with legislators where employees have met with them about information, and they've only given them about half of the information that they needed. And as a result of that, I've had to come forward with the other half. And so I don't think that, obviously the supervisor's presence sends a chilling effect. I agree. But I would only say that in my own experience, I know of situations where it's very selective on the information that's being provided. And I think that that can be on any issue and by anybody. I understand that. But I think that there are instances where it would be nice for the employer in this conveying of information to tell the whole story.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've been very lucky. I've worked with the government agencies for 12 years, both as a staff member and as a legislator, and I've never run across this problem in talking to different agency personnel. I guess I'm very fortunate based upon what members have said here today. But perhaps we need to consider a couple of things. One, if you do experience a situation where you feel that the agency staff member doesn't want to talk to you because they fear retribution, I mean, those are comments that you need to communicate with Mr. Larson here so that he can address the matter. I think we're not doing our due diligence and following through on that side of things, and I don't see how this legislation would necessarily change anything. We need to do the, our part in talking to him so he can figure out what the problem is and address the concern. But then the other thing that perspective that I'd like members to consider is, with what Mr. Representative Nelson here just said, we need to consider that agency personnel might not want to talk to us because we're the people that set their budgets for their state agency, and they may not want to tell us the information because they're fearful of what changes that we make that will impact them individually that they maybe don't like. And so it's not, they look at us as the kind of being the bad guys, and that's the reason why they don't want to talk to us. Not that they feel retribution from their supervisors, but that they feel retribution from us. So I think we need to consider that a little bit, too. So that's just my comment, 2 cents on this.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, just to respond to the testimony, there's 3 points regarding the testimony. One, this doesn't change the categorization of data and the protection of data. Data is governed by a different part of the Minnesota statutes, and this does not change the nature of what's public or not public. Second, the idea that because there could be litigation that we shouldn't do this, the courts are there to protect rights. We have 3 branches of our system for a reason, and it is a place where people go of last resort, but it is the fact that there's a remedy that could take people to court is not a reason not to do something. The third point is, who do the state agencies work for? Do they work for the governor and the governor's top 2 political appointees at the agency, such that when I have a question for somebody at an agency, I can't get an answer unless I go through that filter and have one of those 2 people at the meeting? Or do they work for the people of the state of Minnesota? I think, the fact that I represent 36,000 people in the northern metro area, I should have access to information regarding the way state agencies function. They collect a ton of information about how our existing statutes work, and they're the people who are best able to tell us things that could work better. And I think the political filters get in the way of really good, clear, data-based ideas coming forward. And then finally, to Representative Anderson's point, this proposed change in the law does not require them to give us any information that we request. It just says that they do choose to provide us with information that they can't suffer retaliation in the workplace. So it doesn't place a burden on them that if I call up and I have a question for somebody in the Department of Ag, that they have to answer my question. That's not the case at all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Mr. Larson. I'm just considering the liability issues around data privacy and liability issues around data. And it seems as though, and I'm not a lawyer, so it seems as though part of the rationale for having the data request system or the system in place for a variety of people, including legislators, is that if information gets out, I would imagine that the state agency is liable, the state is liable for that information getting out there in an improper way. So is that a consideration as well? Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it certainly is. We're, you know, the data that state agencies have is depending on, you know, whether you're, just about every agency has confidential private data on individuals or data on with regard to information. I know that I can only, there have been times when we've had private data where we would like to give it to legislators to set the record straight, okay, and we haven't. And the reason we haven't is because of the protection under the Data Practices Act. I'm not a data practices expert, but I can say that in the discussions that I have had with legislators, we have had those discussions, and the legislators have basically wanted to make sure that they're not treated preferentially and that they follow the appropriate protocols for the data. And so I think in answer to your question, in somewhat of a roundabout way, I would think that if an employee contacted you and came with a huge folder of data, I would advise you not to open it. Because I think that there are proper protocols to make sure that the release of that data is appropriate. And if an employee did that, I think that we would take serious action against that employee.
Any further discussion?
All right.
Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 3807 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of Thursday, March 13 and Tuesday, March 18.
Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Simon, did you have a point?
I did. Thank you, okay. Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if you might tell us what your thoughts are about post-deadline hearings. I know you had made reference in a week past to the fact that you wanted to hold some, or at least one that you talked about. Any words?
There will be at least two post-deadline hearings. One will be on legislative reform. That will be two hearings. It will be done with a representative from the National Council of State Legislatures. The second hearing will be a post-review of technology across the agencies. They will take place after the Easter break, probably the second week of April. Second week of April is when we will start. We have had a number of members outside this committee that wish to attend the legislative reform segment, and so we will make sure that everyone is invited to that. So that is what we will do after Easter break. Oh, Mr. Malander reminds me we need to hear the pension bill also, so we will have to have a hearing on that. Oh, and we have to confirm two more members to the campaign finance board. I can only hope that these are previous members who know exactly what the chair would like to see. Meeting is adjourned.